During our story for all ages today, we heard a story about bees making honey who were overworked and underpaid. Thank you, Cal. The demand for honey was so high that Caesar and his bees worked day and night, year around, with no weekends and no holidays and no time for doctor's appointments. The bees' honey was so in demand that little bees couldn't go to school. They just all worked and worked and worked. Their suffering was great, but their cries of misery went unheard. People demanded more honey for their sandwiches, and they didn't care if the bees were dropping dead from exhaustion. They needed honey, whatever it took, to get more honey. Now, Caesar, our buzzing activist agitator, has some options. He can advise his bees to sharpen their stingers and go on the offense, making their disapproval known through vicious stabs in the arms and legs of people obsessed with honey. He could try to work his way up into bee management, which wouldn't solve the problem right away, but eventually he might be able to create change, and he would probably get better vacation. Or he can organize a bee strike. A strike it is, and after an assist from the hummingbirds, the bees are successful. Their demands are met, and the baby bees return back to bee elementary school. And every bee gets 2 days off a week to play bee soccer or watch bee football on television and eat bee junk food, whatever that looks like. As I imagine, you have realized this story is about Labor Day. It's a story of unionization and resistance to corporate greed, because tomorrow is, after all, Labor Day, and despite what I think advertisers think, it's not just about sales. It's a national holiday, and it was recognized in 1887 by Grover Cleveland, after U.S. citizens on vacation enjoyed Labor Day in Canada. Those Canadians, always a bad influence on us. And they lobbied to have a similar holiday in the United States to celebrate and recognize the efforts of the labor movement. Spread over several centuries, the labor movement gave us things like weekends and an 8-hour workday and restrictions on child labor. Unions are controversial today, but in truth, they always have been. In many ways, the struggles and the successes of the labor movement are reflections of the struggles and the successes of the people of this nation. The ugliness in our history is the ugliness of the labor history, of labor history. The movement's greatest challenge was solidarity. Sure, union leaders repeated again and again that solidarity was the key to fair working conditions. The miners and the factory workers and the farm laborers had to stand together or fall together. Their only power, their only playing card was in true cohesion. But the day-to-day reality of the labor movement was always more complicated. The issue was race. Did African Americans belong in unions? Initially, the answer was almost unanimously no. The Knights of Labor Union was inclusive, but most unions thought the black people weren't worthy of membership. This backfired time and time again. Most seriously in St. Louis, which is the site of our present-day race debacle in Ferguson. So in St. Louis in 1917, corporate bosses were tired of the union's demands for higher pay, and so they recruited African Americans from the very, very poor Deep South to come up north and work for them. And this wage that the African Americans could earn was much higher than they could earn in the South. Much higher. Made it worth relocating their entire family. But it was less than the white union members were asking for. This was a corporate trick that was used time and time again in the time after slavery's emancipation. If white employees complained about pay or working conditions, bosses would turn around and threaten to replace them with black workers, because they would work for less. Simple racism kept white employees from organizing with African Americans. They weren't going to mix with people of color, even if it meant the solidarity that could bring them higher pay. So again and again, companies ignored union demands, and when union members went on strike, they brought in black staff so they could keep their businesses running. Well, in 1917, racial tensions in St. Louis were so high that when white workers went on strike and corporate head honchos went forward with their threats of bringing in African Americans from the Deep South, a riot broke out in the streets around the factories. But instead of the union members rioting against unfair corporate practices, they rioted against black people who had come up to work, and they killed 40 black Southerners and 4 white supporters. Didn't make any sense. They were fighting against African Americans, but they weren't really angry with them. They were angry with the corporations. Finally, by the end of the century, unions realized they couldn't be successful without black members. It was too easy for workers on strike to be replaced by African American people who struggled to be employed in any industry for any wage and who didn't feel sympathetically toward union members who didn't think they were good enough to belong in their union. Solidarity between black workers and white workers saved the union movement, and after World War II, industries that were unionized were the most desegregated sectors of American life. People of different colors didn't go to school together, they didn't worship together on Sunday mornings, they certainly didn't socialize together or eat in the same restaurants even. But in unionized businesses, they worked together side by side, and union members called each other brother and sister, regardless of race. Early in our service, Joe shared a poem by the theologian Tandaka, a Unitarian Universalist seminary professor and a scholar, and a feminist and a person of color. Tandaka writes, "Despair is my private pain, born from what I have failed to do, failed to say, failed to overcome. Be still, my inner self. Let me rise to you. Let me reach down into your pain and soothe you. I turn to you to renew my life. I turn to the world, to the streets of the city, the worn tapestry of brokerage firms, drug dealers, private estates, personal things in the bag lady's cart. Rage and pain in faces that turn away from me, afraid of their own inner worlds. This common world I love anew as the lifeblood of generations who refuse to surrender their humanity to an inhumane world courses through my veins. From within this world, my despair is transformed into hope. And I begin anew the legacy of caring." Despair, she writes, is her private pain. The pain she bears alone in the quiet of her soul. Despair born from all she has failed to say and failed to do. In the wake of the Ferguson shooting, despair has been my private pain. Despair not only at what I have failed to do, but because I don't know what to do. Because I feel powerless and small in a world of hurt, a world of white privilege that I benefit from, but don't know how to dismantle. So what does our poet advise? Be still, my inner self. Let me rise to soothe you. In times of despair like these, I need to reach down into my soul and find the peace there, find a place of calm centeredness, and sit inside it and let it nurture my brokenness. A meditative silence, a moment of prayer, an internal safe harbor you can allow to rise and soothe you. Our poet turns to this internal harbor to renew her life, and then, only then, once she has strengthened herself, she is able to turn outward. I turn to the streets, to the world of the city, the worn tapestry of brokerage firms and drug dealers and private estates, personal things in a bag lady's cart. Rage and pain in the faces that turn away from me. This is how we manage our grief. This is how we rise up for justice. This common world I love anew as the lifeblood of generations who refuse to surrender their humanity in an inhumane world courses through my veins. We feel the pain of the world. We reach inside for our inner place of comfort, and soothed, we are able to turn our gaze outward again and see the bag lady and the addict and the systemic racism that's breaking down the lives of people of color. We see all of this suffering, but fortified by our inner calm, by our spiritual practice, by our church family. We don't have to turn away. Despair need not be our private pain. And our poet reminds us, in the suffering that we witness together, there is hope. There is resilience. This common world I love anew as the lifeblood of generations who refuse to surrender their humanity in an inhumane world. We can look upon the homeless woman, the addict, the everyday unceasing racism, and see that despite all the hardship our brothers and sisters face, they survive, they succeed, they carry on, and we are inspired again and again. From within this world, my despair is transformed to hope, and I begin anew the legacy of caring. These are the steps to creating radical change in our racist society. First, we remember that our despair need not be private. We all suffer from guilt and despair and hopelessness in the faces of great injustice, like the murder of Michael Brown in St. Louis. We all feel the pain of the mother and the father who still wake up every morning expecting to see Michael walk in the door, who are shocked and devastated every time they realize that their Michael has joined the legion of people of color murdered because of white fear. But from this pain, we mustn't turn away. We mustn't ignore it and move on. Instead, we reach inside ourselves and we find our sanctuary, a place of strength that makes it possible for us to turn to the world with all its trouble, all its suffering, and find inspiring resilience in the gate of the bag lady. See, generations who refuse to yield their humanity to an inhumane world. And we are inspired and we fall in love again with our broken world. The labor movement finally learned that solidarity meant standing with people who were both black and white, leaving our comfort zone to stand together. And this Labor Day weekend, we're reminded that solidarity is our greatest hope for racial justice in our fragmented world. So last week, I assigned you a few homeworks to do, a few blogs to read, Color Lines, The Roots, This Week in Blackness, and to have one difficult conversation about race. To sit down with another Caucasian or two and ask them when they first noticed race. Ask them about what made them uncomfortable when they spent time with people of color. I can't wait to hear your thoughts on the reading and hear all about your conversations. So please do share with me what you found. This week, I have a little more homework for you. I promise this won't become a regular thing. A shorter read, but no less challenging. It's called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. Has anyone read that yet? I bet it's familiar to a lot of educators. Yeah. It's a common meditation on race, and I think you'll find it really interesting and really meaningful, although initially it's pretty challenging. I'm also guessing that it's going to spark some great conversations. So if you want to gather and talk about it, send me an email, or grab me, or give me a call. I would love to put together an informal small group to discuss race and whiteness. Okay, I'm going to put it on the site, on the website too. It's called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. It's all over the internet, but I'll put a link on the church website and on the Facebook page. As we learn from Caesar the Bee, the labor movement, and from Tandaka's poem, despair need not be our private pain. This work of dismantling racism isn't about guilt. It's not about what we're doing wrong. Solidarity, not white guilt, is our motivator. Standing together, the unions could demand a reasonable work week, safer conditions, and an end to child labor. Without racial solidarity, they were powerless. But when black and white stood together, radical change happened. Let us stand together in recognizing our white privilege. Let us stand together so that from within this world, our despair is transformed into hope, and we begin anew the legacy of caring.